Theme this morning is the presence of God, and we'll be looking at the whole of Psalm 139. The whole of Psalm 139, verses 19 to 22 of the psalm, seem so shocking to some people that they are embarrassed about them. And at first glance, these verses look like an outbreak of vengeful hatred that are unworthy of an Old Testament believer and a New Testament believer. Words like this: if only you would slay the wicked, O God. They speak of you with evil intent, and so on. Do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and abhor those who rise up against you? Arguably, those words are the key to our understanding and appreciating the psalm. In what circumstances is David, the author, writing this psalm? Well, the clue is in David's cry here in verse 19. Away from me, you bloodthirsty men. In other words, David is not here sort of sitting in a library polishing a chapter in his systematic theology on God's omniscience and on God's omnipresence. David is in extremis. David has people who are chasing him, who want to kill him. They are bloodthirsty men. He's running for his life. It's taken him away from home. He's hiding in caves, wherever he can find shelter. There is no familiarity in his surroundings. He has, verse 23, anxious thoughts with very, very good reason. His reference to the depths or to Sheol is not theoretical. Sheol in the Hebrew is the place of the dead, with no particular reference to the particular destination of any individual, but with reference to this life. If you're no longer in this life, but you have departed, you have gone to Sheol, to the place of the dead. And that's not theoretical to David. He thinks that any moment now, he may be entering Sheol. He's a sword thrust. He's a thrown spear away from dying. And when he lies down to sleep in one of these cold caves, he literally does not know whether he will awaken alive in the morning. David is frightened. David might die soon, and it may be in unpleasant circumstances. Now that seems to me to be very important because it clarifies the mood of the psalm. As David refers to the presence of God and God's knowing all there is to know about him, it is not the frightening presence of God that he's running away from in fear. It is the glad presence of God that somebody facing threats and running away from mortal danger is feeling. The kind of presence of God that David is writing about and rejoicing in is that kind of presence that emerged when I was speaking to the children earlier. It's remember when you were a child and everywhere you went, your mum was the ever-present reassurance. You were safe because she was there. You only had to turn around and see her there, and it didn't matter that you didn't know the way home because she was with you and would get you home safely. And the only thing that makes you fear and panic is when you turn around and she's not there. That's what causes you to be frightened, the thought that her ever-presence would be gone. And that's the only ultimate fear that David has. That's the mood of this psalm. God's presence and his knowledge of all of my circumstances is my great anchor and it's my great encouragement. And if I lost it, then I would panic. The presence of God. Let's just work our way through the psalm then under these four headings. It breaks down naturally. And we look first of all at God's informed presence, verses 1 to 6. I mean, there's a sense in which you come to the psalm and you say to yourself, is the psalm about God's omnipresence? In other words, he's present everywhere. Or is it about his omniscience, that is, that he knows everything? And you immediately, I think, after a moment's thought, realize that from our point of view, at least, these two are tied together. It is precisely because God is absolutely everywhere in the whole of his being all of the time that he knows about absolutely everything. Nothing escapes his notice. The God who is with me, verses 1 to 6, knows everything about me. And for David, that is a great encouragement. I want us just initially then in these few verses to notice the words that David uses to indicate the degree of knowledge, comforting knowledge that God has about him. Verse 1, he has thorough knowledge. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. To search is to investigate or to examine. Now, of course, God doesn't need to Google in order to find out. He doesn't move from ignorance and, after a process of searching and investigation, discover what he previously did not know. But the language of searching conveys that God, what God knows about me, says David, is as though he had come to the end of a minute investigation and search, so that he had discovered everything that there is to know about me. So the God who is with me knows absolutely everything about me. There is absolutely nothing that he's going to overlook. He knows me. He knows my apparently inconsequential movements, when I rise up, when I sit down. He knows the stuff that nobody else can possibly know, my innermost thoughts. He knows them from afar. What does that mean? I think that means that, you know, when you're driving up to a billboard, it's so obvious and so conspicuous that from a mile away you can see what it says. That's what the advertiser intended. And it's as though David is saying, my thoughts, which are secret to myself, that nobody else knows, these anxious thoughts that I have, God can see them from a distance. They are obvious to God. He knows them all. He knows all my ways and he knows all my words. It is complete knowledge. Verse 2, it's perceptive knowledge. Do you see that? Depending on the translation, you understand or you perceive my thought from afar. God is not just in possession of data. God hasn't just collected information about me. But God knows with insight. He has perception into my circumstances. He knows what other people don't know. So David's on the run. He has companions around him. Together they are fugitives, and maybe David's companions, looking at David, King David, think to themselves, well, this is David the slayer of Goliath. This is David who would never have a frightened thought or an anxious moment. But God can see how frightened he is. And God can see how worried he is at the outcome. God knows the real situation. And so he does with you and me. So you're sitting there this morning and you look like a mature, steady, brave Christian on the surface. And underneath are those frightened and anxious thoughts that God discerns. He has, verse 3, discriminating knowledge. You, verse 3, scrutinize my path and my lying down. Or you discern my going out and my lying down. The word there is to winnow. So if you're a farmer and you've harvested the wheat and you've got the grain and you've got the chaff in a pile and the grain is valuable to you and the chaff is worthless, you want to separate them out. what is valuable and what is not valuable, and so you throw them up into the air and the wind takes away the valueless chaff and leaves you with the valuable grain. That's what God is doing here, says David, with his thoughts. He's winnowing. He's scrutinizing them. He's distinguishing them. That he distinguishes them in a way that we can't even do with ourselves. That in one moment we are a complex jumble of trust in God, but at the same moment fear about what's going to happen to me. And I wonder then, as I'm on the run from these bloodthirsty men, is God going to abandon me? But I do trust him, and God is able to untangle those thoughts, to distinguish between them, to strengthen the trust and to weaken the fear, so that the one eclipses the other. And then if you look at verse 4, he has foreknowledge. He has foreknowledge. That's the crowning feature of God's knowledge of me. He knows it all in advance. That's how much he knows me. Comprehensive knowledge, complete knowledge, perceptive knowledge, discriminating knowledge, foreknowledge. There's nothing he doesn't know about me. He knows everything. He knows it all in advance. And so when with a sort of a free heart, I went to visit my doctor and came away with a devastating, unexpected, unwanted diagnosis. It wasn't a surprise to him. He knew it in advance. And that matters. That must matter. He knows all about me, says David. And how does David respond? He's gripped by this truth. He hasn't just collected big words and information about God's knowledge of him. He's comforted by this truth. Verse 5, you have enclosed me behind and before, and you have laid your hand upon me. God is behind me and in front of me. In other words, for anything, for anyone threatening to get close to me, they have to get past you first. And you have laid your hand upon me. You are within arm's reach of me. You are that close to me. I can feel the warmth of your breath upon me. I can feel the warm hand of God upon my shoulder, he's saying. The hand that reassures me. The hand that is mighty. The hand that is comforting. The hand that is reassuring. The hand that protects. That's David's response. It's not theoretical knowledge. He's comforted by this truth and then ultimately worships God for it. Verse 6, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is too high. I cannot attain to it. The presence of God with me, he says, is utterly profound. And whereas then his pursuing, bloodthirsty pursuers had loomed so huge and large in his experience, now God looms larger still. That as God gets bigger and bigger and bigger to his mind, the God who is with him, the God who is in front of him and behind him, protecting him, so that his enemies must get past God in order to get him, that eclipses the threat. And he's lost in a sense of worshipful wonder. God's presence is informed. God knows everything about David, about you, and about me. And while in one sense that's intimidating and causes David to bow down and worship God, it is profoundly encouraging because that God is on his side. We move on, secondly, to verses 7 to 12, to God's inescapable presence. God's inescapable presence. Now, when David says, where can I go from your spirit and where can I flee from your presence? We are not to think that David is trying to flee from God's presence. I'm not sure, but perhaps his sentiment is something like this, that as I flee from my bloodthirsty enemies, wherever that flight takes me, you are there. Fleeing is on his mind. That's what he's doing. He's running away from people who want to murder him. And he's saying that wherever I go in my flight, knowing that you are there, gladdens my heart. There is no conceivable state, there is no conceivable place, there is no conceivable threat that can separate me from God's presence. There's no state that can separate me from God's presence, says David. If I ascend to heaven, verse 8, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, behold, you are there. There's no state that I can be in which God is there. So obviously God is in heaven, but is God in Sheol? Sheol, the state of death, the place of death, that where everyone goes from this life when they die. Why is he thinking about that? Because it could happen to him before he wakes up tomorrow morning. He's staring Sheol, unfamiliar language to us, but he's staring death in the face. And he's thinking about the unfamiliarity of death, the strangeness of death. Nobody wants to die alone. You frequently hear of, and I believe that this is very common, of battle-hardened soldiers on the battlefield, and then they've received a mortal wound, and they're lying there, and they can feel in their pain their life draining away, and they cry out for their mothers. Because, as we saw with the children earlier, they don't want to die alone. And their mind turns to the most comforting presence that they can imagine, that ever-present mother whose protective, warm presence they experienced throughout their childhood. And David says, if I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. Now, when I thought about that in preparation, that encouraged my heart so deeply. Because I, like you, am naturally scared of death. And when you feel that pain in your chest and you think, well, could this be the heart attack that's going to take me? Where is it going to take me? To that place that is so unfamiliar, that is so strange, that maybe using this sort of strange Hebrew word for it is appropriate for us because it captures for us the unfamiliarity of a world in which I will be disembodied. What's it going to be like? Where I must leave my wife behind. I do everything with her. I love having her with me. It's her companionship that makes everything enjoyable. But there I will have to be all alone. But no, says David, you won't be all alone. You are there. Let that lodge in your mind. Let whenever your instinct is to fear death, think of this. That if I make my bed in death, behold, you are there. I will never be alone. God will be there. God who is my Savior, God who is my Father, God who is the God and Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, Jesus will be there. The one who has gone to Sheol, the one who has tasted death, the one who is familiar with that place that I will be entering, the one who has gone there in order to prepare a place for me so that when I enter into that world, he will be there to receive me. You won't be totally alone. That's deeply, deeply encouraging. God will be there. The most horrible place, God will be there. He will be there. When I went to Serbia with PTI, I can't remember his name now, but there was an elderly gentleman who travelled with us. He had very recently lost his wife, and he'd obviously, the two of them had been deeply attached to each other. And I can remember just He easily dissolved into tears, and it was understandable, but he spoke of the sense of the fact that his wife, having departed his presence, had immediately gone into the presence of the Lord. And he imagined her then and there, as we were sitting there in the airport terminal, she is with him. That's wonderful, isn't it? That's what David is describing. God's inescapable presence. No state can separate you from God's presence. No place can separate us from God's presence. If you have a look at verses 9 and 10, if I take the wings of the dawn, if I dwell in the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me. Why does David have remoteness in mind? Well, it's obvious, isn't it? He's a long way from home. He's running for his life. He's laying his head in this cave after that cave. Remoteness is his home in the circumstances he finds himself in. Why would he have the sea on his mind? Probably because in the Hebrew mind, the sea, the Mediterranean Sea, represented all that was vast, all that was unfathomable, all that was threatening, turbulent, unpredictable. Imagine being in a fishing boat on the Mediterranean in a wild storm. That's a picture of the circumstances of David's life in these circumstances. Threatening, unpredictable, unknown. And you can translate that into your own experience. What are you facing now that is strange, turbulent, unfamiliar, threatening, unpredictable? And what can you expect to find there? Even there, your hand will lead me, and your right hand, that which is strong and full of skill, will lay hold of me. I've told you before of my friend Roland Eskenazi, pastor in Brussels, who always signs off his emails with these words, "In his grip." In his grip. That's where David is. In the remotest parts of the earth, where I'm on the run for my life, and I don't know whether I'll wake up in the cave tomorrow or in Sheol, I'm in the grip of his right hand. No state, no place, no threat can separate us from God's presence. Verses 11 and 12. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, and the light around me will be night. Even the darkness is not dark to you, and the night is as bright as the day. Darkness and light are alike to you. Darkness, that's a universal, isn't it? We're all afraid of the darkness. David must be afraid of the darkness. Who's going to emerge from the darkness with a spear in his hand or a sword in his hand to kill him? It's full of threat. And interestingly, the original language is, if I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me, will bruise me. It's the same word as Genesis chapter 3 and verse 15, where the Lord says, I will put enmity between you and the woman, between your seed and her seed, and he shall bruise you on the head, and you will bruise him on the heel. What happened? Was it of no significance what Christ suffered at the hands of Satan? No, it was really threatening. He really suffered. This is what David is anticipating, that he's going through an experience and a period of darkness that will bruise him. There's real threat in it. There's real menace in it. And what can he expect to find there? That the presence of God will remarkably nullify the threat. He turns the darkness into light. There is no darkness to God. There is only light. He won't remove the experience. Certainly David is having to live through it, but he will nullify the threat in the experience. God's inescapable presence. What a comfort and an encouragement that is to David and to you and me. There is absolutely nowhere in this universe, there's nowhere in this life, there is nowhere in the life to come, there is no experience that I can possibly undergo where I could possibly, as one of God's people, escape God's encouraging presence. Thirdly, God's protective presence. God's protective presence, verses 13 to 18. Now, these are familiar words because we've often turned to them to think about how it is that God has fearfully and wonderfully made us in our mother's womb. And you may wonder, why is it then that David on the run for his life, stops and reflects on his conception. And I think it would be right to say that David's thinking is like this, and it's a profound encouragement for us, that if God invested such skill in making me in the beginning, he's not going to abandon me now. So it's directly relevant to his present threatened circumstances. If God invested such skill and care right at the beginning of my life, he's not going to abandon me now. Now, I don't want to embarrass my wife, but Carolyn, like all the others, I'm sure, puts tremendous care into baking cakes for mainly music. I know she's not the only one who does that. And then because she's not going to mainly music and because I am under instruction to get those cakes safely to mainly music. Don't go herring off and leave them behind in the kitchen. I put a lot of work into making those cakes. Be careful that you place them on the level in the car so that they don't tip and fall over. I put a lot of effort into making those cakes. Don't go too fast around corners or braking too rapidly, because then that cake is going to slide and smash against the side of the container, and then Susan in the kitchen will have to scrape it off the edge. I don't want that happening. I put a lot of care into making those cakes. And because I've threatened to do this, don't cut a slice off and eat it before you get there. Because I want it to arrive whole. It matters what it looks like. I put a lot of care into the shape and the icing and so on. And if it's got a great big slice out of it, then it's not going to have the same effect. You see, because when you've invested skill in something, and when you've invested time and care and devotion into something, you get precious about it. Matters to you what happens to that thing. You don't say, well, I now couldn't care less. And that surely is how David is reasoning. He's saying, you formed my inward parts. You wove me in my mother's womb. Verse 15, I was skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. We actually looked at this briefly at Christmas time. I don't have to elaborate now. God designed me, he said. God put thought into me. God employed, the analogy is the skill that one of those Middle Eastern rug weavers puts into designing a hand-woven rug, selecting the colors, the yarn or whatever it's called, and weaving it all together with tremendous handmade skill. That's what God has invested in me. He's not going to abandon me now. He's not going to abandon me now. Why would he? Having invested so much in me. And therefore, David, in his plight, remembering that God had invested all of that skill in making him at the beginning, is overwhelmed with a sense of present security that that gives him. Verses 17 and 18, how precious also are your thoughts to me, O God! How vast is the sum of them! If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. When I awake, I am still with you. And so here is another occasion in the psalm in which David breaks out in response to the great objective truth about God and God's presence, and he worships God. But what is he actually referring to? What thoughts is he referring to? How precious also are your thoughts to me. He is surely thinking this, that God is thinking about me. Now, that was the other thing that really struck me as I was meditating on this psalm. The God of the universe, the infinite God, the God who is from eternity to eternity, the God that holds all of the nations in his hands, the God who has purposes that he hasn't revealed and that are to us that are inscrutable, the God who is up there and massive and way beyond everything in power and in knowledge, thinks about me. He has thoughts in his mind about Bruce Jenkins. That is amazing. About King David. Turn that over in your mind. And it's not just an occasional fleeting thought. How vast is the sum of them? If I should count them, they would outnumber the sand. I am not, says David, for a single moment of my entire life, from my remarkable conception, throughout all my days, up to this time when I'm on the run from bloodthirsty men, in whatever state I am, in whatever place I am, under whatever threat I'm facing, he never, ever, ever forgets me. He has thoughts of me. I am in his mind. And those thoughts are numerous. Encouraging, isn't it? Is that encouraging to you in your circumstances right now? God's protective presence. Finally, God's holy presence. God's holy presence. It just seems inevitable that there is something about the thought of God's presence, as we've been looking at it, that inevitably leads God's people to hate evil, both in others and in themselves. God cannot possibly be everywhere present and we live as though he's not there. And if God is indeed like this, verses 1 to 18, then it is absolutely impossible for me to be indifferent to evil in other people and in me. And so David hates evil in others as we ought to, and he hates evil in himself. He hates evil in others, verses 19 to 22. These are the words that sound unworthy of an Old Testament believer, and perhaps more unworthy of a New Testament believer. And as we read those words, we may be thinking, where is the love your enemies, and where is the pray for those who persecute you in what David has to say? And of course, those great statements of the New Testament are valid and are true, but there is another and an abidingly valid truth surely contained in these words in Psalm 139, that God's people, because of God's present holiness, are intolerant of wickedness. Striking words in Psalm 97 and verse 10, hate evil, you who love the Lord, who preserves the souls of his godly ones, he delivers them from the hand of the wicked. Hate evil, you who love the Lord. Of course, in David's case, yeah, there's a personal edge to it. David's on the sharp end of bloodthirstiness. These are people who want to take his life. He has a vested interest in his pursuers being brought to a quick and a sticky end. But in one sense, that's the whole point, isn't it? That there is no, you can say, I hate wickedness, but I have a completely different attitude towards the wicked. The trouble is that wickedness isn't harmless. There actually is no situation in which you can justify wickedness on the basis of it's okay, you can do that as long as it doesn't hurt anyone. Wickedness always hurts somebody. Wickedness is profoundly harmful. So there is a personal edge to it, but David surely, because his mind has been meditating upon and is full of this glorious greatness of God in all of his complete knowledge and of his presence everywhere, David is, who has been moved to praise and to worship that God is like this, is driven by wanting to defend the honor of God's name. Verse 20, for they speak against you wickedly, and your enemies take your name in vain. David is not saying that the problem is that they're speaking wickedness against me, and I, the anointed king of Israel, that they're speaking wickedness against me. The problem is that they are speaking against you. This God whose omnipresence and whose omniscience has so gripped me and overwhelmed me that it's moved me to be comforted and to worship him, everybody should think that way about him and worship him. And they speak against him and they blaspheme his name. That's absolutely intolerable to David. He hates evil in others. Verse 21, do I not hate those who hate you, O Lord, and do I not loathe those who rise up against you? It's not that they hate me that hurts me most, it's that they hate you. It's remarkable, isn't it? A man on the run for his life and he's concerned about the honor of God. Verse 22, I hate them with the utmost hatred. They have become my enemies. In other words, your enemies have become my enemies. Because I'm on your side, anyone who is against you, I'm against them. Your enemies are my enemies. You are my God. I've aligned myself with you. You are the one who's close to me. I depend on you. He hates evil in others, but it leads him also to hate evil in himself. So the psalm comes to a close with David crying out to God, search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my anxious thoughts, and see if there be any hurtful way in me, and lead me in the everlasting way. In the midst of all of my anxious thoughts, in the midst of the fact that I am largely preoccupied with my own dangers and escaping with my life, help me not to lose sight of what's really important and not to harbor any hurtful, evil, God-dishonoring way within me. Because if God is indeed like all of this, Psalm 139, then there is no place for evil in me. The presence of God. Don't get it wrong. It's not a fascinating reading around the subject. And you read people splitting hairs about it. One of the theologians says the divine omnipresence means rather the presence of all things to God than God's presence to all things. They are in his presence, but he is not in their presence. That seems to me to be splitting hairs. I don't think that David concerned about himself when he was on the run, whether I'm present to God or God is present to me. Some of the things that are stated about this doctrine are preposterously inaccessible and have been written by theologians who have obviously not got out of the library. Quote, theologians are accustomed to distinguish three modes of presence in space. Bodies are in space circumscriptively. They are bounded by it. Spirits are in space definitively. They are not everywhere, but only somewhere. God is in space repletively. He fills all space. You won't remember that, will you? Not when you're on the run for your life. What we need is David's childlike confidence that God is like an ever-present mum, that I'm safe because she is always there. And if I were to turn around and find out that he were gone, that's when I would panic.